This song actually was sung by Lochan Das Thakur, and unfortunately, we don't have a translation for this song. It's a we have well, fortunately, we have a purport, Srila Prabhupada's purport, but it's very long. So Srila Prabhupada liked this song very much because it's describing how these two lords, Gaur and Itai, are the most merciful. They're Paramakaruna. They're the most merciful, and their mercy cannot be put to any type of logic, because their mercy is so great. It describes in the rest of the song, it describes how they even made the animals and the trees and the plants dance in ecstasy. So who can put any reason, any logic to their mercy? So it's a nice song. So today we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 19 and text 210. Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. So the verse that's written on the board is 2:13, because that has a purport. But I'll start from two verses before, because those have translations. Shantarase swarupa buddhye krishna kanishtata shamoman nishtata buddhye iti shrimukta gatha. When one is fully attached to Krishna's lotus feet, one attains the shamatha stage. The word shamatha is derived from the word shama. Therefore, shantaras, the position of neutrality, means being fully attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. This is the verdict from the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This state is called self-realization. Purport. The word shama is explained by the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the following verse. Shamo man nishtatha buddher iti shri bhagavad vacha tan nishtha durghata buddher etam shantaratim vinam. These are the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Quote, when one's intelligence is fully attached to my lotus feet, but one does not render practical service, one has attained the stage called Shantarati or Shama. Without Shantarati, attachment to Krishna is very difficult. This verse is found in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 3147. So now today's verse. Shamo Manishtata Buddhir Dama Indriya Sangyama Tiksha dukkha sammarsho Jivo pasta jayodhriti Shamo manishtata buddhe Dama indriya samyama Tiksha dukkha sammarsho Jivo pasta jayodhriti. Shamo manishtata
buddhe.
Matajis. Chamo manishtata buddhe ma indriya samyama vidiksha dukkha sammarsha Shama, neutrality, matnishta, attachment for me, buddhe, of intelligence, dhamma, self-control, indriya samyama, controlling the activities of the senses. Titiksha, tolerance. Dukkha, of unhappiness. Sammarsha, endurance. Jiva, tongue. Upastha, and the urge of the genitals. Jaya, conquering. Dhriti, control. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Yeah. The word shama or shantarasa indicates that one is attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. Dhamma means controlling the senses and not being deviated from the Lord's service. Endurance of unhappiness is titiksha, and dhriti means controlling the tongue and the genitals. Please repeat. The word shama or shantarasa indicates that one is attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. Dhamma means controlling the senses and not being deviated from the Lord's service. Endurance of unhappiness is titiksha, and dhriti means controlling the tongue and the genitals. Purport. This verse is from Srimad Bhagavatam 11.19.36. The conditioned soul under the clutches of Maya, the material energy, is very much agitated by the urges of the tongue and the genitals. Control of the urges of the tongue, the belly and the genitals, which are situated in a straight line, is called dhriti. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Tara madhya jivayati lobha mois durmati. Among the senses, the tongue is the most formidable enemy of the conditioned soul. Urged by the tongue, one commits many sinful activities. Although Krishna has given human beings nice food, people still commit sins by killing poor animals for the satisfaction of the tongue. Not being able to control the tongue, the conditioned soul eats more than he needs. Of course, everyone must eat to keep the body fit for the Lord's service. But when one cannot control the senses, he falls victim to the dictates of the tongue and the belly. Naturally, genital agitation follows, and one seeks illicit sex. However, if one is fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna, one can control the tongue. Bhaktivinoda Thakur further states, Krishna bada daya moi garibare jiva joy. In order to conquer the tongue, Krishna has been very merciful and has given us nice food that has been offered to him. When a person is attached to Krishna's lotus feet, he does not eat anything not offered to Krishna. Sai anna mrittakao, Radha Krishna gunagao, premadaka chaitanya nitai. Since the devotee only eats prasad, he conquers the dictates of the tongue, belly and genitals. One can control the dictates of the senses when situated in the position of shantarasa. Then one's advancement in Krishna consciousness is assured. Om jnanam timrandhasya jnananjana shilakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave nama shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam yena bhutale sayam rupa kadam payam tadati svapanantika. So I always find that the verses that I get oftentimes to read or to speak on are very relevant, and very relevant for me, because if you probably notice, you might find me generally in the evening in the maha room eating maha prasad. So it's very true. It's like whatever you need to work on, Krishna brings that into the purport. So this this verse is about controlling the tongue, and controlling the tongue. Before, I used to think that, well, that's, we say that controlling the tongue is the most difficult thing. It's the most challenging sense, but that seems quite easy. I mean, compared to the other senses, controlling the tongue, it's like I never in my life pine to eat meat or you know, you can give up certain foods. It's not so difficult. But actually, because Krishna is so merciful and he gives us his prasadam, and he gives us this wonderful prasadam, therefore we often don't realize how difficult, actually, how formidable the tongue is, how difficult to control that sense is. And we actually come to that realization on days of fasting, right, when we actually have to fast for like 24 hours. And then, you know, when that sense is not satisfied, you could say, when the tongue isn't satisfied, we can't think clearly, we start to become delirious, the mind becomes unfocused. So then we actually see that, actually, how much we're dependent on the tongue. And whereas the other senses, they disturb us from time to time, once in a while, the tongue is, in some ways, always on our case. It always needs to be satisfied. And actually, to give up different types of foods is very difficult. It's like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, at a young age, he gave up eating mango because he didn't offer the mango to Krishna. So he thought, well, now from this time on, I won't give up the mango. So I was thinking about that, that actually that's very difficult. I don't think I could do that, personally. Like if he was asked to give up the mango, you know, it's very difficult to do that. And the tongue is that one sense also for which Prabhupada here is making the point. It's that sense for which people will kill others, right? Will take to such cruelty just to satisfy that sense. For the other senses, like the genitals, Prabhupada is also mentioning here, people may do that sometimes. It's if it becomes very degraded, so someone goes and kills someone else out of anger. So we see that. But in the material world, it's for the pleasure of the tongue that so many millions of animals every year are slaughtered, right, in the slaughterhouses. And then people may be even aware of that. They may even see the pain that an animal is going through. But that, you could say, that lust for that taste of meat, people actually, they savor the taste of meat, that is so great that even though they know that, even though they know that it's causing pain to another animal, it's cruelty, it causes great pain, but still people aren't able to give it up. We're not able to give it up. I was attending one conference that happened on, it was like a science and religion conference, and the topic just happened to be, in that conference, because people are becoming aware of this, happened to be like animal ethics and animals. It was like animals, you know, how does science view animals, how does religion view animals. And it was interesting that with scientific advancement, you know, they get so you know, different types of information, and some of these scientists were coming up and first speaking, you know, they had people from the science side and the people from religion, and every single one of the scientists, they were saying how the latest research, how it was confirming that when animals are killed, or when they're, you know, when their throat is sliced, or they're killed in any way, the same chemical reactions take place in the body as when humans are hurt or killed. It's the same functions that are going on in the body. Which means that, because we, you know, we can't talk to animals, so no one knows. Before, it used to be, people say, well, your animals, they actually don't feel as much pain as humans do when they're killed. You know, that's why it's okay to kill them, but not okay to kill humans. Because we're more sensitive, we feel more pain. But given that they can actually now measure this and say that it's the same functions going on in their body, the conclusion of this conference, you could say, the seminar, was that based on scientific reasons, one can no longer say that it's ethical to eat meat. In other words, scientifically speaking, one cannot justify anymore the eating of meat, because it would be ethically wrong, just like it's ethically wrong to kill a human because of the pain that's caused, nor to eat the animal. Similarly, it's ethically wrong to kill the animal. So scientifically, it's now sort of confirmed, you could say, that and people are aware of this, that it causes the same amount of suffering to another living entity, to the animal, as it does to the human to be killed. So then they said that the only reason one could actually justify eating of meat, it was because people generally don't like to talk about this, because then you have to, if you talk about this, you feel guilty, and then you feel guilty, then you have to give up eating meat. But then they said, well, the only way you can justify this is based on religious reasons, the eating of meat, because in Christianity it says, well, the soul of the animal is lower, it has a nutritive soul rather than a human soul. So this is sort of like the response. It was like, so therefore actually it's good to be religious now, because if you're religious, you can actually continue eating meat. Whereas without that, if you put religion aside, then obviously it's ethically wrong to eat meat. So this is what Prabhupada says, is when people can also use religion for material purposes. There's a material motivation to religion. Whereas actually demoniac in some ways, it's worse in some ways. And just recently I was sitting with one Indian student who was also studying in a different course, but he was in a different college, but we happened to meet. And so he was vegetarian for some time. He was vegetarian for some time, and then he started eating meat again. And he was from India, and his parents are vegetarians. And I told him this also. I told him about this thing, because he's a chemist, you know, so he's really into science and everything. And I said, scientifically, there's no reason you can do this. There's no reason that you should eat meat. He knew that. He knew very well. I mean, it doesn't really take science to figure it out. Like, if you break the neck of a chicken, you can see it's suffering. But it was just, he said, yeah, but I'm not willing to give it up. Because, you know, right now, it feels okay. It feels all right. You know, I'm in university, so it feels okay. So, I mean, this is the urge. This is how Prabhupada is saying here. He says, people are willing to, although Krishna has given human beings nice food, people still commit sins by killing poor animals for the satisfaction of the tongue. So it's the ultimate form of sense enjoyment, that my sense enjoyment is so important that I'll even take your life in order to enjoy my senses. I'll do that. So therefore, in other places Prabhupada says differently, but in some places Prabhupada says that of the four principles, no meat eating is most important, because the spiritual life begins in some ways on the principle of ahimsa, of non-violence. Until we're non-violent, until we're not committing violence to another living entity in any way, be it physical violence, mental violence, and until we stop practice this principle of ahimsa, then we cannot make significant spiritual advancement. And it's actually true. I mean, you see, many Christians in their own practice, you know, formally sort of their church or their tradition may allow the eating of meat, but generally they give it up. I've seen like those who are following it very staunchly, after 10, 15 years, it doesn't seem right for them to eat meat. It just, from their heart, like Krishna says, if you're sincerely coming after me, then I give the realization from within the heart to come to me. So many Christians I found I mean, there's two students in my own course who are Christians, and they had given up eating meat. Because you actually feel it. At a certain point, you cannot make further advancement. One cannot make further advancement without the giving up of meat. So this is, you could say, basic form of controlling the senses, is to give up, first of all, these unavoidable items, like the consumption of meat. But then it's saying that any sort of gratification of the tongue is detrimental or slows down our spiritual progress. And Prabhupada here, in the way that he defines it many times, he's defining it as not eating something, or eating something which is not offered to Krishna. That's the general principle, you could say. Once we follow the four regulative principles, then this is the next sort of general principle, that we only eat things that are offered to Krishna. Why is this? Why is there so much focus on prasad, and even though we eat prasad, but also at times, like when we're traveling or this or that, when we feel like just eating something from the store, why we avoid eating outside foods is because whatever we eat, the consciousness of the person who's preparing that food affects our own consciousness. Right? Our consciousness, we're trying to, through this process of chanting and hearing, we're trying to cleanse the consciousness of the dirt that's been on there for millions of lifetimes. We're trying to cleanse the consciousness from material desires and material characteristics. But then when we eat food that's outside, when it's contaminated, then it contaminates our consciousness. So it essentially slows us down. It slows us down in our progress in spiritual life. So someone may say, well, what's the harm? You know, just a little bit, I can, you know, eat. I don't eat anything outside, but I eat some item from outside or something like this. I eat bread or something like that. Yes, I mean, there's no, it's not like breaking the regulated principles, but Srila Prabhupada gave the example. It's just like if someone told you that here's a very nice preparation, but it just has a little bit of poison in it, just a little bit of poison, you know. It doesn't have much. It won't kill you if you eat it. You know, it's completely safe, but it just has a little bit of poison in it. Then we won't take it, right? We say, no, I'll avoid it. I'll try not to eat this thing because it's better for my health. It's more favorable for my health not to consume this food. And that's where the whole idea of organic foods comes in, right? Because it said that non-organic foods just have a little bit of poison in them, and that's called chemicals, right? They spray them with chemicals. So then people try to avoid those types of foods, and they try to buy organic food. So in the same way, when the food is cooked and offered by devotees, then that food becomes like organic food. It becomes spiritual food. And it doesn't maintain the impurity in that. There's actually a nice story in the Mahabharata regarding this, showing the power of what we eat, showing the power of how whatever we eat affects our consciousness. Does anyone know that story by any chance? There's many stories in the Mahabharata, right? So it's kind of hard to say. But this is the story of Bhishma. Jai Shishanatha Gopinath. Bhishmadev, or you could say the story of the disrobing of Draupadi. So Draupadi was the Pandavas were in this gambling match, right? And they were playing this game and all these things. And due to the influence of gambling, Yudhishthira Maharaj couldn't stop gambling, and he ended up gambling his brothers, and then finally he gambled off his wife, Draupadi. So Draupadi became the possession, according to the Kauravas, Draupadi became their possession. So then Duryodhan ordered his brother Dushasan to bring Draupadi into the assembly of the Kauravas, and then in front of all the Kauravas to disrobe her. Now you can imagine this is a very heavy scene. I mean, it's Draupadi was a queen, she was a princess. These are all noble, you could say, coming from noble families, Kshatriyas. And Duryodhan, being very evil, is ordering this to happen. Now in that assembly, Bhishma Dev and Dronacharya were also present there. And these were the elders of the society. They were very wise, very respected, and they were elders. Now, the gambling was, you could say, in some ways, a Kshatriya dharma. They couldn't stop that because the Kshatriyas, they're allowed to gamble. It's an easier way of winning a kingdom than fighting for it. You know, there's less bloodshed. So you can say, okay, let's see our skill in sport. Whoever is better at the sport wins the fight in some ways. So that's why it was allowed for the kings, because it's like sometimes kings used to do it among their warriors, right? They would say, okay, I'll put my best warrior forward and you put yours forward, and whoever wins, that side gets the kingdom. So in the same way, this is like with gambling. It's like, okay, we'll play a game, and in the game we'll have two parties, and then whoever wins gets the kingdom. So until now, the gambling was Kshatriya dharma. They couldn't stop it. But the disrobing of Draupadi, even if they won Draupadi, even if Draupadi was their possession, still the disrobing of any woman in public was against dharma. There was no justification for that. It was completely sinful, it was evil, it was the breaking of dharma. So when Draupadi is dragged into the assembly, then she goes to all the elders and she says, why are you allowing this? But they remain silent. Right? They remain silent. They don't stop it. So then we know the story that they try to disrobe Draupadi, but Draupadi calls out to Krishna, and Krishna comes to her rescue. And so once this incident happens, then the Mahabharata sort of reflects on, well, why did they allow this to happen? Why did this happen? This incident. Why did Bhishma and Drona not stand up and stop this? And so we know, because Bhishma is a Mahajan, the internal reason is that Krishna actually asked Bhishma that when this happens, don't say anything, don't speak up. Because it will be this sinful act that they do which will justify all of them being killed in the battle. Then if they're evil enough where they will do this if you're not present, so let their evilness come out, and then that will give me give the justification for them to be finished, for them to be destroyed. So that's the internal reason we know. But the external reason is described, that actually the reason why both Bhishma and Drona did not stop Duryodhan at that time was because Bhishma and Drona were both accepting food that from Duryodhan's kitchen, it said. They're eating the salt of Duryodhan. And because they were eating his food, and because they were associating with him, and essentially eating the same thing that was arranged by him, their consciousness became influenced by his mentality. Their consciousness became like his consciousness, and therefore they couldn't figure out at that time what is dharma and what is not dharma. They couldn't make a distinction between the two. So, I mean, this is a pretty far-out story. It's pretty intense. But it's Krishna, you know, does these things through his devotees to show us, to teach, to instruct society about the power of eating food that's not offered to him. So, This is the importance, you could say, of we have that. So we have both of those things. Prabhupada always emphasized the chanting of the holy name, and then along with that, he always emphasized the eating of Krishna Prasadam, because the chanting of holy name by itself is sufficient to take us back to Godhead. But if we eat prasad or if we don't eat prasad, then it slows down our it slows down that same progress. And then Prabhupada is making the point that how once we control the, we're able to control the tongue, then the other senses, the belly and the genitals, which are all situated in a straight line, they also become very simple to control. So one way we control the tongue is through, by what we eat, but the other way is through what we say, what we speak, right? And that's why the tongue is so important also, because the tongue is the only sense that has two functions, and both functions are very, very powerful. So that one is the chanting of Hare Krishna, right? So that one is when we engage the tongue in glorifying the holy names of the Lord, in repeating the Lord's name, then automatically we hunger less for material things. So they both go hand in hand, and that's why when the tongue is used for the glorification of the Lord, then it's also very easy to give up the taste for material foods, you could say. Because it's described that Parikshit Maharaj, when he was absorbed in hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadev Goswami, when he was hearing for hours and hours, day after day, then ultimately he lost all hunger and thirst. He was able to conquer all of his the whole desire to eat altogether. And Prabhupada many times he says that ultimately this is the purpose. All the rules and regulations, they're bringing us to this point that we can actually bring eating and sleeping and drinking to nil. We don't have to eat anything, or we have to eat very little. Like the Goswamis, they used to eat one small cup of buttermilk. So Parikshit Maharaj, he describes that how through the hearing and the reading of Srimad Bhagavatam, he was able to give up this hunger and thirst. Now, for Parikshit Maharaj, this is very significant. Because why? Why is it very significant that he that through hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, he is able to give up hunger and thirst? Specifically in his case, what was very special about him? Yes. His thirst. Yes. The reason why he was cursed to die in 7 days, in other words, the reason why he was meeting death, was because he was not able to, before hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, he wasn't able to control the urge for thirst. Right? He was in the forest. He was thirsty. He was thirsty like anything. And then he went to the sage's ashram. And he requested the sage, please give me some water. And the sage was in deep meditation. So the sage didn't reply anything. And then he became very angry at the sage, and so he put a dead snake around his neck. So it was because of thirst that he was cursed, and this whole problem came about. And then it's showing that Srimad Bhagavatam and the hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam is the solution to that problem. That by reading and hearing Srimad Bhagavatam continuously, he was drinking, he describes. That's why Krishna consciousness is also described as a taste, right? In Krishna's pastimes as amrita, or nectar. He was drinking the pastimes of the Lord. And by drinking that nectar, he lost his taste for this lower nectar, or his taste for thirst. And so many times in the ultimate sense, the control of the tongue is described as is as drinking nectar and giving up poison, right? So we have to drink something, right? It's the nature of the tongue to drink something. But material activities, in the general sense, and material enjoyment, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in this nice section, it describes that's like drinking poison, right? That's material enjoyment is enjoyment, but it's like the enjoyment of drinking poison. But spiritual happiness is replacing that poison with drinking nectar. So the ultimate means of controlling the tongue is to drink nectar, it says, to drink the nectar of the pastimes and activities of the Lord. There's one very nice story of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where one Brahmana, he offends one of the devotees of the Lord. I think it's Vrakreshwar Pandit, and he offends the Lord, so then Lord Chaitanya will not see the Brahmana anymore. So this Brahmana becomes very disheartened, and he becomes completely distraught and unhappy. And so he goes to Lord Chaitanya and he says, well, what's the solution for my offense to him now? Because he was no longer there. I think Vrakreshwar Pandit, he left, and so he was no longer there. And then Lord Chaitanya, he says, now, with the same mouth that you used to offend this devotee, to criticize him, with the same mouth you go and you glorify the devotees. So he says, just like with the same mouth one can drink poison and one can drink nectar, in the same way, it says, with the same, and one can solve essentially the problem by drinking nectar. So in the same way, he says, in general, in anything, one can either drink poison by saying the wrong things or engaging in useless talk, but then with the same mouth drink nectar and glorify the activities of the Lord and his devotees. So I'll stop here and open it up. Dronacharya is actually, in a few times in the Mahabharata, and Rasamandala Prabhu will know this, may correct me, he's criticized a few times in the Mahabharata, because for this exact reason, that he's a Brahmana, but he tends to always be too much involved and get himself too much involved in Kshatriya business, in the administrative business. During the battle, I think, when he's, because he's a Brahmana, he's super powerful, he's like a, he has Brahminical power. And so when at a certain point when he's destroying the battle left and right, the Pandavas army, and he's just cutting them to pieces, then I think Bhima, because the other Pandavas, especially like Arjuna and Yudhishthira, Dronacharya being their teacher, they won't say anything to him. You know, they'll just keep quiet. But Bhima, he's more courageous. So at that point, he'll insult Dronacharya, and he'll say, "What is this Brahmana doing on the battlefield? He's in the wrong place. You know, this battle is supposed to be between Kshatriyas, and he's coming here and he's ruining the scales for us because he is more powerful than the rest of us." And he should be in front of a fire sacrifice. What is he doing here with bows and arrows and killing people? So Dronacharya, you could say, had a bit of this problem, you could say. As far as I can understand, he wasn't supposed to be living in the palace or eating Duryodhan's food. So his dharma was contaminated. Therefore, his understanding of dharma became more like nationalism rather than actual dharma. And in the case of Bhishmadev, he should have just rejected Duryodhan's food. In other words, he didn't still have to eat his food. Just like Vidura was a good example. Vidura, he was so pure and he would give good advice and everything. And that was because Vidura is described, he was a minister and he would stay far away from the palace in a very simple cottage. And so therefore Krishna would come and eat at Vidura's place. He wouldn't come and eat at Duryodhan's place, but he'd go to Vidura's place because he was living far away from the palace. And it's described that one time he goes to Vidura's home and Vidura offers him banana peels instead of bananas, just out of ecstasy because he was trying to serve the Lord and he got so ecstatic, so he accidentally offered him the peels rather than the banana. And so Krishna ate that, you know, very, very happily. He thought it was very delicious. So that was the case of Dronacharya. But for devotees who are living in the temple, I think it's they're in a very nice situation because they can accept the prasad offered to the Lord. Yeah, I think it gets hard sometimes when devotees are living outside of the temple. Then there's a tendency, even myself I've seen, to go and buy foods that are pre-prepared, that are prepared by outside. Mm. Oh, I see, like that. I think that's a nice question about Varnashram, but I think this case is slightly different because they're from the case of kings and brahmanas. And the reason I think it's slightly different is because the temple is more like an ashram. It's not exactly like a kingdom. So the management itself, they themselves are in some ways brahmanas. It's like they're looking over the running of the temple. So just like before in previous times, there were ashramas and there were sages there or different saintly persons there who were running the ashram. Now, just because they were running the ashram didn't mean that they suddenly became kshatriyas or administrators. They were running it and they had and then the senior or the older sages would look after or train the younger ones, the younger students who would come in like that. So I think that's more the model for our temples, that everyone is sort of involved in spiritual practice, and it is a brahminical, you could say, community. Therefore, so much separation doesn't have to be there. But I think Srila Prabhupada, in his system, he did set that up in some way, and that was his system of having the president and then having the GBC, because the president is more like day-to-day involved in management affairs, and so but the GBC is sort of set apart, so they're not dependent or taking favors from the president in some way, so they should in that post they should be in the place of giving advice, more like brahminical advice, and that's why I now in ISKCON they have this very they have this rule that the two need to be different. They say that's why, because of that sort of balance, the Brahmana and Kshatriya sort of a balance. So, thank you for that. Yes, I mean, yes. To a certain degree, like Srila Prabhupada, he said that if the husband is not following the regulated principles, so he's breaking the four regulated principles, then it's you could say, then the wife has a justification to leave the husband because it's so much it's too, you could say, too heavy, the contamination, you could say. But on the other hand, the wife or a member of the family may be part of a household, or a citizen may be part of the kingdom or the government, but can also remain aloof in the sense that they can also advanced spiritually very rapidly and still be in that situation. So what Bhishma, for example, Bhishma didn't have to leave Hastinapur. He didn't have to leave, you could say, Duryodhan's kingdom. But he didn't have to eat everything that Duryodhan was eating. So like we see that sometimes, that like there's one family in the town that I grew up in, Boise, where the wife became a devotee and the husband still isn't interested in Krishna consciousness. So he's a vegetarian now and he's very friendly to the devotees and everything. But sometimes, you know, he wants to go out and eat at restaurants, vegetarian food, but eat out at restaurants. So he goes out and eats. And but you know, she won't go out and eat, but she'll accompany him or something like that. So it's not necessarily the case. In other words, Prabhupada also had that example of the lotus flower, that we can be surrounded by unclean water, but the lotus is, you know, transcends it in some ways. It rises above it. So so in any situation we can be Krishna conscious, but there's certain things that the devotee will accept and certain things that the devotee will not accept. I guess that's the thing. Yes, and that's always difficult. It's something that we practically face is like we go to home programs, right? And people like to cook and offer devotees food there, and so it's essentially it's finding the balance between the two, and that's what Srila Prabhupada also showed in his example is that the devotee finds a balance. So if the home program is at a person's place where they're still eating meat, right? So the devotee, he may offer the food for them, in other words, as a favor to them, like you're saying, as preaching. But the devotee may decide still not to eat there. Although there are a few cases where Srila Prabhupada did, but it was like a very sort of special circumstance where he accepted something, even though in that family meat was being cooked, he accepted some fruit or something like that. But generally speaking, it's like if someone's, you know, they're vegetarians and they're coming to Krishna consciousness, and the devotee can make the offering. So sometimes devotees have this rule that, okay, we'll eat if we can make the offering, which is important because otherwise, you know, they'll offer it to Durga or Shiva or something like that, and you don't know what. So if they're coming to Krishna consciousness and the devotee can offer it, then that's sort of okay. I mean, a devotee finds the balance. He says, okay, I can accept prasad there. What do you have anything to say on this? Yes. Yes. I was wondering about that myself also. Actually, it's a very good point, because they describe it that he was eating the salt of the Duryodhan. And I honestly, I really don't know the answer to that, because I've heard about grains, that how, you know, Kali enters the grains on certain days. But there is something to salt, like you're saying, because in India also, many Brahmanas, they'll have this rule that they'll go to people's homes and they'll accept sweets so they can eat desserts, but they won't accept salty items, because there's something with the salt. So sugar is fine, but salt isn't. So yeah. Yeah, there's something to do. Right. A high conductor, a very high conductor. I see. Well, definitely before, salt was very difficult to get. It was a very prized item. And it was like, so in some ways, the basis of food. So maybe that has something to do with it, is that it's just like, you can't have food essentially without salt. So it's like it's salt. That's interesting. Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.